The economy is causing a crisis for the young, both here and abroad.
The young are becoming disconnected from political processes, fed up with systems that have no effective answers for the job crisis.
A global jobs crisis for young people, and when foreclosure hits home. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. There's been an uptick in home sales across much of the country in the first quarter of the year, but the prices are down, way down. Homes in some stage of the foreclosure process saw their share of overall U.S. home sales grow in the first quarter, driven by a spike in short sales. Short sales, sales of homes for less than the bank is owed, are up 25% from a year ago, according to foreclosure listing firm Realty Track Incorporated. That is a three-year high. Without a short sale, the next step is repossession by the bank. But there's a human story to all these homes being lost. When you're a teenager, it's hard to understand how the economy has anything to do with your life. But when Michaela White's dad lost his job and their home was foreclosed on, it got personal.
My dad wrote this song for me when I was 16.
She's slipping away.
But each time he played it, I refused to listen.
Before you say those things you've got to say.
Why did my dad write me such an emotional song? And why didn't I ever listen? In the end, I guess I blame it all on the economy.
Remember this. I've loved you from the start.
My dad's a project manager in the steel construction business. When I was a kid, growing up in Glendale, Arizona, his job was going really well. We had money to spend on a nice house. But back then, nobody saw a recession coming. So when it hit in 2008, my dad lost his job. I was a freshman in high school. My dad looked everywhere for a job in Arizona, but ended up taking one in Utah. My parents decided to live apart for 18 months so my older brother could graduate. That was great for him, but it meant that I would be moving with my parents at the end of my sophomore year.
You were in denial about it.
This is my mom.
I felt like you weren't acknowledging it, and maybe that made it even harder.
Maybe it was because I was a teenager, or maybe it was because my parents had started fighting more. But I felt myself losing respect for them, so I told myself I didn't really care when my dad moved to Utah. One time I visited him in the dead of winter, and his apartment was kind of empty. Just a blow-up mattress, a couple of dishes, a chair, and his guitars. And it seemed like he wasn't even a part of the family anymore. For my family and for me, this year marked the beginning of our loss of control. But all I saw was more freedom. My mom wasn't as strict, so I thought I had more control over my life. Meanwhile, just 3 months before we were supposed to move, my dad's company in Utah was closing. We couldn't believe it, but he found a job in Oregon and moved up there to begin. Some people say things have to get worse before they get better, but for my family, it seemed like the bad storm just kept coming. But what seemed super unreal was the day that we got news that our house was being foreclosed on.
The hardest part I have to say about losing the home is that we tried so hard. We didn't walk away from it. We had it on the market for over a year.
We really did not expect the market to be so bad for so long. We kind of thought if we waited it out for a year and a half or 2 years that it would bounce back. And we brought three short sales to Fannie Mae for consideration. They were supposed to be considering those and extending foreclosure of the home. So when one morning, out of the blue, we got the message that they were foreclosing that morning at 10 o'clock, and we had 10 minutes to try to do something, we didn't even get to someone at Fannie Mae that we could talk to in that period.
So Fannie Mae auctioned off the house for significantly less than what we could have sold it for. But that still left thousands of dollars that we had to pay off.
So how much money do we owe now?
how much is it? $58,000.
So we can't pay that, and that's why we're filing for bankruptcy?
That's right.
That's correct. Yeah.
Something this big was harder to ignore, so that's when it hit me. I had to move. My boyfriend broke up with me, and I assumed it was because we were moving. I began to resent my parents more than ever.
Not only did it start out having Dad work out of state for 18 months so that we could keep you on solid ground as long as we could, but when that time came that we had to uproot, it was one of the hardest things we've ever had to do. And seeing that you were unhappy, that's something that a parent never wants to see.
In Oregon, I was stuck in a small town with no friends. It was summer, and my mom did all she could to occupy my time. But spending a lot of time with your mom isn't exactly your idea of a good time when you're 16. And what was even harder was learning to live with my dad again. I had changed in the 2 years that he was away, and I refused to let him back in.
Did the fact that I was on and off 5 different depression meds worry you at all?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're very worried.
I had never been on medication like antidepressants before. I thought that they would help put control back into my life. But something wasn't working. My doctor, worried about suicide, was switching medications every 3 to 4 weeks.
I don't know a lot about that kind of med, but it seems to me that they weren't giving each one of them enough time to really see if it was effective or not.
Finally, summer ended, school started, and I met a friend, Hannah. Hannah and I had a lot in common. We both liked photography, the Pixies, and we were both depressed. Both of our families had moved around a lot and were in financial trouble. We were inseparable. Hannah made these friends who were drug dealers, but I knew that they were good people, and we were happy around them. My parents knew that Hannah had gone downhill, but when they found out that I was slipping too, they began to worry.
We didn't really know the dynamics with you and Hannah, but...
We just didn't know, honey. We'd lost communication.
We had so little feedback that we had these dots to connect, and the dots, there was so much space between the dots that had to be filled in with really no knowledge of what was going on.
I almost stopped talking to my parents completely. Even though we lived in the same house, they started sending me emails to try to communicate with me and give me advice. Like, here's an email my dad sent me. If you learn nothing else from me, please learn that you are responsible for your own happiness. Much of what happened to us is not within our control. Happiness is an internal peace that comes from knowing that you have done your best in spite of the outcome. I rarely responded. Things were bad. My parents knew it, and I knew it. But I didn't think that happiness was something that I could control. They seemed like they were the ones that took it away from me. If they didn't like it, I thought they should just send me back to Arizona.
I felt like I had never been more distant from you in our entire life. I didn't even feel like I knew you anymore. As much as I did not want to let you go, I was afraid that I was going to lose you if we stayed. And I wasn't willing to take that chance.
So one day my parents told me I could move to Tucson, Arizona, where my brothers were attending college, 2 hours away from Glendale. I said yes. I thought all along that as soon as I got back to Arizona, my depression would go away. And I quickly realized that just being in Arizona wasn't going to solve the problems I had developed in the past 2 years. On my own, I had to discover something my father had been telling me all along.
The biggest reason to be alive is to find happiness for yourself.
And it's true. I needed to find happiness wherever I was. I needed to control my own life. It's been almost a year since I moved back to Arizona. Being independent made me realize how much control I had all along. There are still a lot of challenges in my life and in my parents' lives. For me, it's balancing school, work, friends, paying rent, and learning adult lessons. For my parents, I figured it would be dealing with the ongoing bankruptcy. But when I asked my mom, she gave me an answer I didn't really expect.
It's the hardest part of life right now.
Being away from you kids, and it's too far.
It's curious to think that the economy was the thing that caused my family to lose so much control. We lost 3 jobs and 1 house. I made 6 moves and attended 3 high schools, all in just 2 years. And still, after all my family had been through, the hardest thing of all was losing the time we had together and our connection to each other. From a distance, I can now see how scared my parents were, how hard they tried, and how much they love me. Every day, I remind myself that only I am capable of removing the sadness that life brings, and that I need to find happiness rather than waiting around for it. I choose where I'm going and who I'm going to be.
Before you say those things you've got to say, before you spread your wings and fly away, remember this, I've loved you from the start.
That report was filed by Michaela White of Tucson, Arizona, for City High Radio.
I am gonna make it through this year. If it kills me.
Coming up, more on the impact of the Great Recession on the world's young people, and one possible answer. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1197. According to the ILO, the International Labor Organization, the unemployment rate for young people is 3 times higher than for older workers. That crisis was among the items topping the agenda of the International Labor Conference held in Geneva in May. ILO Chief Juan Somavia applauded young people who are fighting against a future that isn't promising much hope for work or an affordable quality education.
It's not unusual to hear young people complain that their parents or other adults simply do not understand them. Juan Somavia, who's the head of the International Labor Organization, says if the issue is joblessness, then young people certainly are right.
In many countries, the disturbing truth is that the young are becoming disconnected from political processes, fed up with systems that have no effective answers for the job crisis. And in many different ways, young people are telling us, you don't listen to us. You don't listen to us.
A recent ILO report finds youth employment will reach 75 million in 2012. The ILO chief says joblessness among young people is 3 times as high as that of adults. Furthermore, those young people who manage to find jobs are likely to be employed only part-time, working on temporary contracts or in the informal sector. Alex, a young man from Greece, expresses the hopelessness of many.
I feel a little disappointed about the fact that I studied all these years and, you know, having your family, that through studies you will make your dreams come true, you will have a nice job, and then you grow up, you understand the whole situation around you, and you think that reality nowadays is really hard.
But, as Somavia points out, young people are not waiting around for a miracle.
There is a powerful reassertion of activism from young people who refuse to accept a future of unemployment, marginal work, and expensive, poor quality education. And they go from social entrepreneurs to trade union leaders. And let me say, I very much applaud this capacity of the youth to react.
Rising youth unemployment is another symptom of the global financial and economic crisis, which started in 2008. The ILO says since then, approximately 30 million people have joined the unemployment ranks, and another 40 million more have simply stopped looking for work. Somavia will leave the ILO in September, and his successor is Guy Ryder.
We need to have our organization change to meet the formidable challenges of the world of work today. And we bring that change in the context of continued faithfulness to the values and objectives of this organization. Those do not change, and our common commitment to them must be stronger than they ever have been before. so that we get the job done.
Guy Ryder, incoming head of the International Labour Organization, the ILO. The ILO says to return to pre-crisis conditions, the world will need to create up to 50 million new jobs each year over the next 5 years. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Now let's look at a possible flip side to this. As many as 60 million additional jobs could be generated through a transformation to a greener economy, according to a new report. The Green Jobs Initiative says this could potentially lift tens of millions of workers out of poverty over the next 2 decades. The study, Working Toward Sustainable Development, Opportunities for Decent Work and Social Inclusion in a Green Economy, says that these gains will depend on whether the right set of policies are put in place. Julie Walker reports.
The UN agencies for labor and environment say globally between 15 and 60 million jobs could be created over the next 2 decades by pushing an agenda of a green economy. Most of the employment gains are expected in agriculture, forestry, fishing, energy, manufacturing, recycling, building, and transportation. United Nations Environment Program Director Achim Steiner says a key to achieving these job gains is through more renewable and efficient energy use, particularly in construction.
The transition towards a greener economy, an inclusive green economy, is in fact an opportunity to create jobs, an opportunity to bring people into the labor market, into the economic and informal sectors in a way that we perhaps have not seen for the last 50 to 100 years.
The report says tens of millions of jobs have already been created by this transformation. For example, the renewable energy sector now employs close to 5 million workers, more than doubling the number of jobs from 2006 to 2010. In the United States, 3 million people are employed in environmental goods and services. In Spain, there are now more than 500,000 jobs in this sector. Ronnie Goldberg of the International Organization of Employers, which contributed to the report, says there are major opportunities for all jobs and enterprises to use natural and human and financial resources more wisely.
If we are able to green all enterprises, we will do a great deal to achieve the right kind of transitions, both for workers and for employers.
However, the study does say that some jobs would inevitably be lost by switching to a greener economy as older technologies give way to new. But for the ILO's Somavia, it's about the bigger picture.
It's not just about creating jobs, I've put emphasis on that, but it's also about reducing inequality and generating social inclusion in a sustainable development approach.
Somavia and Steiner say sustainable development goals need to be one of the outcomes of the UN's Rio Plus 20 conference to be held in Brazil in June. Those goals can be then used as part of a roadmap for the greening of the economy, which in turn could generate millions of jobs. Julie Walker, United Nations.
Those reports come to us courtesy UN Radio. Finally, let's go from the economy to ecology. It's a good reminder that everything's connected. There's a life form that quietly touches everything on the ground, and though we associate it with death and decay, life as we know it would be impossible without it. Come for a walk in the woods and learn how this mysterious form of life, neither animal nor vegetable, shapes our world.
From the Encyclopedia of Life, this is One Species at a Time. I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro. I'm pretty sure you haven't heard this one before. What is all around us and very hard to see, and both dismantles and shapes our world.
Okay, let's have a little look for another log.
Lynn Boddy, an ecologist from Cardiff University in Wales, is the one who gave me the idea for the riddle. She's shuffling through the leaves in a little patch of forest in Concord, Massachusetts.
Oh, look at this.
She spotted a soft birch tree log lying on the forest floor. Boddy kneels down and starts tugging on the log.
We've turned over this log. Can you see this?
Oh, yeah. A few limp cream-colored threads descend from the rotting log and make their way into the soil. They look like plant roots to me, but I'm wrong.
What we're looking at is the main part of a fungus. Most of us think of fungi as things like mushrooms and toadstools, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's the fruit body, and the fruit bodies are like the flowers of flowering plants. There's another part of the fungus. It's usually hidden in rotting wood and in the leaf litter on the forest floor.
They're really helping to kind of connect this rotting wood to the soil.
That's exactly right, they are.
These fungal threads, or mycelia, are doing the work of decomposition, slowly digesting and feeding upon this birch tree. One example is the sulfur tuft fungus,
Hyphaloma fasciculari,
an organism that grows both in the U.S. and in Britain. Body gingerly holds the mycelium and begins tracing it through the soil.
Oh my goodness, it's attached to an acorn from this oak tree. So it's not only decomposing the wood of the birch tree, but it's decomposing this old acorn.
A little farther along, the fungal threads have grabbed a hold of another little acorn hat, crawled along its perimeter, and surged out the other end in search of something else to colonize. A branch, a tree stump, or another log. Nutrients consumed in one part of the fungi get routed into this vast, interconnected mycelial network. And if one part of the network gets chewed up by a woodlouse, say, or stomped through by a deer, it's no big deal for the fungus. It's so interconnected that there's little risk of chopping one of these fungi in two. Body loses the trail when the mycelia plunge straight down into the soil. But this fungal tapestry doesn't just carpet the forest floor.
In all of these trees that you see around us, there are fungi within the trunks and branches, not doing very much, just tiny little pockets. And then the minute that the water in the sapwood of these trees stops flowing, these fungi will grow into bigger mycelia and start the decay process. So the minute this tree comes down, or even before decay has started, then spores will land and they will try to get in, and it will have landed on a network of cords on the forest floor, and that fungus will get in too. And so we have a battle going on in this wood.
A greedy battle over the nutrients locked up inside the newly dead tree. So that's one portrait of the fungal community, lying in wait, wood thirsty, and skirmish prone. But there's another side to fungi, the benevolent side, and the second half of the riddle, what not only dismantles, but also shapes our world.
None of these plants in this beautiful woodland would be here if it were not for fungi, for two very good reasons. One is that the fungi which are decomposing actually release the nutrients that can then be used by the trees around. And the second reason is that all of these plants, every single one of these plants around us, have fungi attached to their roots.
These mycorrhizal fungi, species like Amanita brunescens here in this woodland, associate with 90% of the plants on Earth. They ensheath the roots, or sometimes they grow in between root cells. These fungi absorb water and nutrients from the soil and share them with the plant. In exchange, the fungi get some of the sugars pulsing through the plant roots.
It's plants plus fungi that make the ecosystems of our planet work.
Plants are, I think of them as independent beings. You know, they just need the sun in order to survive. But you're saying that they wouldn't stand 1 minute without fungi.
Yes.
In fact, Body says that plants needed fungi to be able to colonize land 450 million years ago. So fungi both nourish and destroy. They pump vital fluids, rich with nutrients, into the very plants that other fungi will later carve up and consume. And they digest the dead, leaving behind the raw materials for new life to be born. It just takes getting your hands a little dirty to trace the weave of their vast network.
Okay, look here. Now, that's interesting, isn't it?
Check out EOL.org to see a couple photos of Lynn Body and to hear about how even bacteria take advantage of fungi. Our series, One Species at a Time, is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.